My name is Larry Rasmussen, and when I'm not at Holden in the summertime, my task is to teach Christian ethics at Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C. One of the subjects of great significance the past few years in the teaching of ethics has been a reevaluation of the traditional Christian positions on matters of war and peace. Indeed, and what I want to concentrate on today and tomorrow is a clarification of the issues. And so I'm calling this two-part series, For Clarity's Sake, Christian Thinking About War and Peace. Today's session is intended to get at the basic traditional framework that Christians have used in thinking about war and peace. And then tomorrow I want to focus upon the recent pastoral letter of the Roman Catholic bishops on war and peace, because that begins to undertake what they call a fresh appraisal of our thinking on war and peace, the fresh appraisal being required by the existence of weapons of mass destruction. We have to think anew about the subjects at hand. So the job then today and tomorrow is one of clarifying issues. Indeed, one task of Christian ethics is to aid people in the hard decisions that they must inevitably make by clarifying the moral dimensions of the issues at stake. And part of that is to hold up those moral dimensions of the decisions that you have to make in the light of the commitments of Christian faith that you hold. So for the next 40 minutes or so, 35 minutes, I want time for discussion. I will try to sketch the broad framework of thinking about these issues that has evolved over the course of millennia, actually. I should say, in light of other sessions here this week, that this is strictly a left brain operation this morning. That is to say, what I'm going to try to lay out is the moral logic in thinking about matters of war and peace. That is not all there is to Christian ethics and all there is to peacemaking. In fact, something like the celebration feast last night here, I would consider as important as what I'm doing to peacemaking. The use of drama, music, many art, many other media are vital to peacemaking, and this is only one of the elements that go into that, namely reflection upon the moral dimensions and tracking some of that reflection. So let's jump into this. Christian ethics takes its orientation from the reality of the coming kingdom, or in different New Testament phrases for that same reality, we take our cues from the new age, or still a different phrase meaning the same thing, from the new creation. It's the power of God's reality and God's reign already partially present in the reality in Jesus Christ that is the centering point for Christian thinking about any moral issue. There is tension, however, between the order to come, the new age, and the present pattern of this world. That's always the case. Throughout the entire biblical materials, you always are working between a tension of a vision of a new creation and its partial embodiment and the present pattern of the world at hand. And the New Testament language is that of the incompatibility of the new age and of the present order of things, the old age, or the incompatibility of the way of God and most of our own ways. So the kingdom or the new age is always pictured as something qualitatively different from our condition of things and something that asks of us with urgency that we change our ways in accord with it. Now, one way to describe the content of the New Age is with the word peace. Biblically, as you know, peace is far more than the absence of conflict. It's not simply the absence of hassles or the fact that there isn't any war breaking out at the moment. Peace, biblically, is a word for harmonious, shared abundance. It's full health in every sphere of life. Walter Brueggemann describes this shalom vision in this way. The central vision of world history in the Bible is that all of creation is one, every creature is in community with every other creature, living in harmony and security toward the joy and well-being of every other creature. And that goes for the realm of nature as well as society. So peace, then, is one way, total well-being, of describing God's intention for all of creation. Peacemaking, in turn, becomes one way of naming the Christian's vocation. Whether you are a physician or lawyer, working in the home, diplomat, or whether you're a parent or child, or whether you're American or Russian, or whether you're married or single, this peacemaking is a way of describing your calling. It's central to the Christian calling as such, whatever our state may be, or whatever the task at hand in any given moment. Now, the inherent tension between the old age and the present order of the world means a certain shape for making our decisions about peacemaking and about peacekeeping. Because God's kingdom is qualitatively different from our own normal state of affairs, there is always a radical critique and judgment that issues from it. No human institution ever merits a blanket benediction in light of the new age or the new creation, when that's used as the standard. All of our human efforts and accomplishments, to say nothing about our failures, fall short of God's glory. Whenever the radical critique of the kingdom of God is blunted or compromised or molded to our comfort, you can be sure that at the same time, the biblical vision of a surpassing peace for all of creation has been acculturated, and somebody's more tribalist and self-serving vision has been substituted. No matter what the state of affairs, no matter how well we like it, it always stands under a radical kind of probing and judgment in light of the new age. Now, how shall we respond to the call to peacemaking that is simultaneously a piercing critique and judgment of our world? That's the time-honored question, and it's received time-honored replies. I'm going to sketch these replies, and then you decide where you are, and then what we must take up tomorrow, in part, is whether these time-honored replies are still themselves valid or whether they must be reappraised in light of modern weaponry. So let's go directly to the issue that's the critical one. The critical issue, morally, is the issue of the justifiable use of force. Indeed, of violence, and in the matters of war and peace, the question of whether there is a justifiable use of killing violence in particular. Now, the use of violence, of course, is an agonizing issue. It's always also an unavoidable one. And if you haven't faced it straightforwardly yourself, you handled it by designating somebody else to do it on your behalf, like calling in the police or conscripting an army. That's how you did it. So one way or another, it gets handled. It's unavoidable. There have been three broad stances that Christians have formulated in answer to that question of whether or not there is a justifiable use of lethal violence. Those are the pacifist reply, what is called the just war response, and what is called the crusade response. All of them, I underlined, root in the more fundamental question, even deeper than the question of the use of violence, the fundamental question about the proper use of power, and especially coercive power, by Christians and others. What forms of coercion might be employed by a Christian in a morally justifiable manner? That's the root question. Are there limits to the kinds and the degree of coercion that might morally be sanctioned? And if so, what are they? So we're not just here dealing with the specific case of threatened or actual war. We're talking about all cases in which the taking of life and even the kind of forcing of life is at issue. Police work, capital punishment, insurgency, self-defense, and some would say perhaps such things as euthanasia and abortion are involved in the same moral framework. Now I have to interject something else about the broad framework in which we decide. It complicates things beautifully. To say that peace is the kingdom's content, and that the new age is the standard of radical judgment and lure for us, and that there is a conflict between the reality of the coming age that Jesus preached and our present order, is necessary and important, but it's not sufficient. We have to keep two more matters in hand. The first is to recognize that the ethics of the new creation are present in the teachings and the life and the death of Jesus. Jesus was, by Christian claim anyway, the very embodiment of the kingdom. What God intends is seen in Jesus with compelling clarity. And you can summarize the ethic of Jesus in shorthand form. He began the summary by summarizing the law and the prophets with the double command to love God with all one's heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. That's Jesus' summary of the moral heritage that came to him. Now, lots of people summarize Jesus' ethic with the love command. I point out to you that he did not do so. That's what he summarized as the moral inheritance. He went on to radicalize universalize the notion of neighbor. It includes everyone, near and far, as among our neighbors, and the enemy as well. And Jesus, if you will, addition to the moral heritage that he inherited was to insist that the love of neighbor extended to love of enemy, whom you ought to treat as you treat yourself. So, for the Christian stance on peacekeeping and peacemaking, the moral norm is in this radicalized understanding of the commandment to love. That's one element we've got to keep in mind, and that changes everything when the enemy is put on a par with yourself. The second element is a different one, but it's still a part of the framework for deciding. Biblically, there are two continuing themes that set the terms for the Christian life. One of those themes is the destiny of the world as God's, that is, the future of creation, future of the whole of things. The second biblical theme is the formation of a community of faith as witness to God's hopes for the world, Israel and the church. The baseline is God's care for and intentions for all of creation. The second biblical theme is that God is forming a people to witness to what God has in mind for the whole. But, you see what happens? That gives you two places of Christian responsibility. One place of Christian responsibility is for creation and the care of it, peacemaking and peacekeeping in nature and society. The second place of Christian responsibility is in the community of faith and its formation and its vocation. That is, peacemaking and peacekeeping as embodied in a visible, identifiable community of worship and praise and work and play, a kind of colony of the new age in the midst of the present order of things. Now, do these two places of Christian responsibility care for the full sweep of creation and being a faithful community of witness ever ask of us two different things that are maybe at odds with one another? Well, let me put it to you in terms of the love commandment. The love commandment surely means at least this, that we should do the neighbor no harm and that we should protect the innocent from harm. But what would you do in those cases when some neighbors intend harm to other neighbors? Innocent neighbors. How do you both do the neighbor no harm and protect some neighbors from harm? I know you'd call the police. Let them take care of it. But that's a different answer for the question that you really have to answer, namely, what is the justifiable use of force, including the real possibility of killing force? If you don't use force, or at least threaten to use it, or authorize someone like the police to use it, then you might abandon that part of the love commandment that says protect the innocent from harm. If you do use force or authorize it, you might well violate that part of the love commandment which says do the neighbor, including the enemy neighbor, no harm. Now that's life in the old age. That's where we are. That's what we're caught with. Now, here's how Christians have sorted things out when such terrible choices are forced by the fact that our world is broken. With few exceptions, all of them have acknowledged that human society does require some kinds and degrees of carefully authorized coercion, including violence and the threat of violence, or else society comes apart. In fact, a war of all against all. Even for some Christian benefits, we all desire, at least the threat of some force is necessary. We want good public schools and a road system and a mail service all paid for with taxes. How many people do you know would voluntarily pay sufficient taxes for those things? We won't gladly do so in any case, but we'd hardly do so at all without some threat of negative consequences if we failed to do so. All I'm saying is that most all pacifists, just war or just violence, justified violence advocates and crusaders agree at this one point that coercion and its threat is a social necessity in a fallen world. Where these three positions, pacifist, just war, crusader, part ways, is on this question. May I, in good conscience, ever use killing violence? And if ever, under what circumstances? The pacifist says, no, I may not, under any circumstances. It is better to suffer this particular evil than to inflict it. The crusader says, I may use killing violence when the cause is just and it is clear that killing is necessary for the sake of the just cause. The justness of the cause justifies the means required to attain the cause's success. That's a crusader position. Now the third one, the just war or justified violence advocate says, yes, I may use killing violence, but only when there are certain stipulations can be met. And I want to go through those with you. But I want to insert an aside here. Just war is a very unfortunate term for this position, because it sounds like wars are presumed to be just when you just hear it. Actually, the tradition operates in a way that assumes that wars will not be just, but that if certain criteria are met, some particular wars, as exceptions to the usual, may be found just, or as agents of just. I just tell you that because invariably when you talk with people about the just war tradition, they say wars aren't just, and then you start listing some possibilities, and then they say, oh yeah, that one might have been. But they assume that it means an assumption of that wars are just, whereas in the just war tradition, the assumption is that a justified war is a rare exception. Now, when is killing violence justified? The just war tradition says, and I'm going to sketch this all too quickly. The Roman Catholic pastoral gets into it in some detail, and so tomorrow we can work on some of the nuances. But the basic outlines go like this. All of the following criteria must be met. Not one, not majority, all of them. What are the criteria? One, the intention must and cause must be good. Intention means the long-term goal as well as the attitude with which the war is prosecuted. For Christians, it would be peace in some form. Restoring rights would be a just one. Protecting the innocent, for example. But killing for national aggrandizement or killing out of simple retaliation, for example, or out of hatred, or to demonstrate heroism, or in keeping with some uncritical patriotism, my country right or wrong, those would not meet the test of justifiable intention. So that's one. Intention and cause must be good. Two, only a just authority can authorize the taking of life. A bandit can't wage a just war. A group of self-appointed citizens can't wage a just war. If there is to be any use of lethal violence, Christians of just war persuasions have said it must be authorized by society through specified channels. It can't be arbitrary. It has to be authorized by socially responsible agents. Now, there are fuzzy and difficult cases for all of these, and I'm well aware of that, but let me state the way the thought has progressed. Third, the means must be limited. They must be limited by the intrinsic rights of some neighbors not to be harmed. So, one of the important criteria for just war is the honored immunity of non-combatants, or third parties, or neutrals, or some classes in a population, the elderly and children, for example, or hospital patients. Indeed, in most cases, the majority of the civilian population. That means that a means of violence that does not respect such distinctions cannot be used. Or if it is used, then the Christian is obligated to say, I don't participate in a war that uses, that doesn't observe this criterion of discrimination, is what it's called. Now, the Roman Catholic pastoral's opposition to nuclear war is based on this limited means criterion. Because nuclear weapons cannot be used in ways that respects the immunity of non-combatants or certain classes, the innocent neighbors. That's one of the bases of their opposition. The second one, and it comes from the limit on means, is the criterion of proportionality. It is simply this, that the means of violence, even killing violence used, must not entail more harm, more destruction, than the good that is to be accomplished. You can't destroy the village in order to save it. if you have means that in fact will result in overall negative consequences, that is, destruction outweighing the good to be accomplished, then those means are out of range. So the destruction cannot be more costly than the good to come of it. So those two, discrimination and proportionality, and hang on to those. Those are the vital ones in the Roman Catholic document. The fourth one, justified violence must be a matter of last resort. If there is any other way to attain a just goal without the use of war, then war is not justified. There are scales here. All legal means must be exhausted before illegal ones are considered. All nonviolent means must be exhausted before consideration of any violent means. Of the violent means being considered, all non-killing violence must be employed before considering killing violence. So there are scales of procedure on this criterion of justified violence must be a matter of last support. Now these, yeah, go ahead. All, you can't consider illegal means until you've exhausted the legal, yeah, and then can't consider violent until you've exhausted nonviolent, yeah. These criteria have been elaborated at great length and applied to a wide variety of cases, and if you want, we can pick up on some of those to see how it works. My main point here is that some Christians have rejected both the crusader position and the pacifist position and identify themselves here and said there is a justifiable use of killing force when certain stipulations are met. One of the groups that has done that is the Lutheran Church. By the confessions of the Lutheran Church, we are a just war church. Doesn't mean that everyone in it stands in this position, but that is the official confessional position. In the Augsburg Confession, Article 16 under civil government, it reads as follows. It is taught among us that all government in the world and all established rule and laws were instituted and ordained by God for the sake of good order, and that Christians may without sin occupy civil offices or serve as princes and judges, render decisions and pass sentence according to imperial and other existing laws, punish evildoers with the sword, engage in just wars, serve as soldiers, buy and sell, take required oaths, possess property, be married, etc. What I find interesting and a bit amusing in this is that nowhere else do Lutherans ever say we can do things without sin. This says that Christians may without sin engage in just wars. Now, how is it that, you know, in our ordinary everyday things, we can't be parents or children to one another, or even friends without sin, but we can engage in war without sin. It's also listed in the same sentence with getting married. I mean, war and marriage. Actually, in my filing system, it's a sheer coincidence, or not coincidence, it's an arrangement of the alphabet, but in my filing system, war comes right before weddings. There's no intentional, nothing intentional there, but it is ratified by the Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession. Okay. Now, why is there not only one accepted position among Christians who claim to look at issues of war and peace in light of Christian faith? Is it just is the problem just the normal human propensity to disagree with one another? Or maybe we're just simply confused. One day we're persuaded this way, another day we're persuaded that way. Or is it the more serious matter we mentioned earlier, namely that in grim circumstances, the commandment to love may tell us to do some actions which are in conflict with other actions, that we can't protect some neighbors without harming other neighbors. Well, those may be reasons enough, but there's another one, and it resides in the two places of Christian responsibility, that I mentioned. Namely, we are responsible for the care of creation, and at the same time, we are called to form a community of faith with a credible witness to peace, and to embody to the fullest degree possible the new age that we see in Jesus. Those two lines of peacemaking and peacekeeping may themselves be in tension with one another at times. Indeed, this is just where the pacifists part ways with Christians who regard themselves as justified violence advocates. Let me explain, although it's going to have to be a brief explanation. The pacifist, like now, in this case, the just war advocate and the crusader, knows that in a sinful world, some force is required for justice and for order. But the pacifist says that somebody needs to embody in the clearest possible way and at all costs, even costs of life itself, the nonviolent peace of the kingdom of God. If that isn't there, then you stand to lose that which God intends for all of creation. Somebody's got to embody that. The Christian pacifist says, further, that the church, as the called out community that anticipates in its own life the new age to come, has precisely that vocation. The church has the task, the pacifist says, to imitate Christ as a sign of the kind of abundant life that is intended for all creation, when nation will no longer lift up sword against nation, and they will learn war no more, and when the tears will be wiped away, and when death itself will die, and everyone will attend the messianic banquet of shared abundance. Is there somewhere, the pacifist asks, a community of such uncompromised, credible witness to the new age? And the pacifist says, that's exactly what the church is called to be. It's the essence of the vocation of peacemaking and peacekeeping. God's people don't have any other calling than to incarnate, as Jesus did, the way of the kingdom in all domains of our everyday life. Okay, so these two places of Christian responsibility, the pacifist generally comes down most squarely in the call to be a set-apart community witnessing to the ethic of the new age. Now, the justified violence advocate says something like this: there certainly is an important place for a rigorous ethic of high witness, and we hope that Christian pacifists do not expire as a species. They've got to be around. But the church that follows that way entirely, ironically, ends up neglecting the care of creation, because it's a broken world. So we face tragic and regrettable, but real, sinful situations. To care for the wider world means unavoidably the use of even killing violence. The best we can do is to employ it carefully in limited and authorized fashion as a lesser evil in circumstances where all of the choices are evil. If we don't do that, then we in effect abandon Christian responsibility for creation around us, and that is unfaithful to our calling as peacekeepers and peacemakers. Well, I mean by this brief explication only to highlight that caring for life in a broken, screwed up, crummy world, and witnessing with the highest credibility in an uncompromising way to an ethic of another age, the new age, these two tasks, both Christian, can themselves be in tension with one another, and they are often the place where Christians take different routes on peacemaking and peacekeeping. Okay, now Let me finish, and then we'll still have 15 or 20 minutes for discussion. I've tried to lay out a broad framework and three choices. What I would like you to do between today and tomorrow, if you haven't already decided, is where you are. Which of those three you adhere to? What you can choose whether you are a pacifist, just war advocate, or crusader. I don't think you've got another choice. If you can think of a fourth position that isn't there, I would be very, very interested in what it might be. It might be the one we're looking for now. And that leads me to some final remarks about our setting, because it is very different in an important way from those situations in which these answers were given by the church in its struggles to be faithful in the world. It is the development of some modern weaponry that has challenged the framework anew. The issue is the same one, namely the use of power in the hands of human beings, and the question of justified use of violence. Those things remain the same. But the magnitude of destruction has changed things by quantum amounts. We represent the first generation that has had in our hands the possibility of extinguishing the possibility of future generations. It's very doubtful whether the word war, as applied to nuclear, is a meaningful word. War is something where there are winners and losers, and we have never had wars that extinguish the possibility of future generations, where life, as we know it, might not go on. So that asks the question, is our thinking about war and peace, also in the church, something which is capable of dealing with the power in our hands and its capacities for violence. In some of the recent struggling with that, the just war people and the pacifists have become allies. And I want to say how that has come about, because generally they have ended up arguing with one another about participation. But let me take the just war theory now and use it for just a few minutes over against the presence of modern weaponry of mass destruction. And when I say that, I don't only mean nuclear, but also chemical, some things that are being worked on, electrical, particle beams, laser, and so on. It's not only nuclear weapons that are weapons of mass destruction. Okay. Just war logic assumes that somebody making the decisions is in control of the events. For medieval princedoms, that probably was the case. To a considerable degree, princes were informed, they decided, their orders were carried out. They might get beat, but they had relative control over the troops and the situation under their command. In modern situations, one thing that one must ask is whether such control is likely. There is much more potential, I think, for deception and error, for loss of clear communications in an enormously complex situation. And once weapons of mass destruction are used, there is the full potential for loss of communications altogether. There is heightened chance of mass panic and outraged national pride and irrational factors that come about in situations of mass trauma. When you have in a civil war situation like we had where this country was founded, one line against another line or one line against people hiding in the forest, that's one kind of situation. It doesn't engage the whole society. When you're talking about mass destruction weapons, you have situations of mass trauma. Can you assume that somebody making the decisions is in relative control of events? The dangers are magnified by the destructive power of the weaponry, whereas the just war logic assumes the rationality of national leaders under conditions of enormous danger and stress. Can you assume that rationality? You have to ask whether that is itself a rational assumption. Let me just read to you a paragraph from the Roman Catholic Pastoral. It asks about the employment of just war criteria in situations of here limited nuclear war. So they ask about, can there be a limited exchange using nuclear weapons that might be justified? You see, what the contention that you have to know about is that some people in the administration and in the NATO alliance have said that limited nuclear war can meet the criteria of just war, limited specific targeting of smaller tactical nuclear weapons. Can meet the just war criteria. They then respond to that by saying, we recognize that the policy debate on this question, namely the possibility of limited nuclear war, is inconclusive and that all participants are left with hypothetical projections about probable reactions in a nuclear exchange. While not trying to adjudicate the technical debate, we are aware of it and wish to raise a series of questions which challenge the actual meaning of limited in this discussion. Would leaders have sufficient information to know what is happening in a nuclear exchange? Would they be able, under conditions of stress, time pressures, and fragmentary information, to make the extraordinarily precise decision needed to keep the exchange limited if this were technically possible? Would military commanders be able, in the midst of the destruction and confusion of a nuclear exchange, to maintain a policy of discriminate targeting? That's the phrase that's used for this. Can this be done in modern warfare waged across great distances by aircrafts and missiles? Given the accidents we know about in peacetime conditions, what assurances are there that computer errors can be avoided in the midst of nuclear exchange? Would not the casualties, even in a war defined as limited by strategists, still not run in the millions? How limited would be the long-term effects of radiation, famine, social fragmentation, and economic dislocation? Unless these questions can be answered satisfactorily, we will continue to be highly skeptical about the real meaning of limited. One of the criteria of the just war tradition is reasonable hope of success in bringing about justice and peace. We must ask whether such a reasonable hope can exist once nuclear weapons have been exchanged. The burden of proof remains on those who assert that meaningful limitation is possible. Traditional just war logic, at least in democratic societies, also assumes a certain amount of democratic honesty, that a citizen can know what's being done in his or her name, and that the citizens can have some say in policy making. But some current policy that nuclear strategy relies upon, like deterrence, says that the citizens don't know and they shouldn't know because bluff is essential to the strategy itself. Deterrence says, at least some of its advocates put it this way, others do not. Deterrence says that it would be morally wrong to use certain bombs, but it's morally right to make people think you're going to use them. To employ them would be horrendously immoral, but not to threaten to employ them would also be horrendously immoral. If you say that this is the way we must go, you simultaneously say that just war thinking, at least in the democratic societies, and its assumption of citizen informed consent by citizens is no longer a matter of that informed consent and democratic honesty is not a matter of high moral value. Now, again from the Roman Catholic letter, this is a complicated matter, and I just want to put it out, and tomorrow we can get at some of the nuances. In the Roman Catholic pastoral epistle, the general definition of deterrence does not explain either the elements of a deterrence strategy or the evolution of deterrence policy since 1945. A detailed description of either of these subjects would require an extensive essay using materials which can be found in the abundance of technical literature on the subject of deterrence. Particularly significant is the relationship between declaratory policy, namely the public explanation of our strategic intentions and capabilities, and action policy, the actual planning and targeting policies to be followed in a nuclear attack. We have declaratory policy. We say this is what our policy is. We also have all sorts of planning, action policy, that is not the same as the declaratory policy. And that's because we say that this cannot all be a matter of citizens' participation and their informed consent. Well, a third thing that's a challenge to just war thinking of modern warfare. Modern war of an escalated nuclear character is not a winnable war on just war terms. Just war thinking says that winning means the good that eventually ensues must be greater than the destruction entailed. If another country's citizenry is more totally destroyed than one's own, that doesn't mean the latter won in just war terms. It means that they both lost and that war was not a vehicle of justice. Two, modern war that employs weapons of mass destruction cannot be waged in ways that observe the criteria of due proportion, that I mentioned earlier, and discrimination, immunity of certain classes, non-combatants, the innocents, third parties, so on. For these and many more reasons that inhere in the character of modern warfare, just war thinking has been challenged. And in the face of that challenge of modern weaponry, just war thinking still insists that the only kind of war that any Christian or any morally accountable person has any conceivable right to let happen would be one that meets the tests of intention, limited damage, proportionality, non-combatant immunity, last resort, and so on. Well, now, if this logic is sound, then what all this means in the face of nuclear weapon strategy is this. Christian participation in the use of killing violence on just war terms could only be for highly specific, limited use of that killing violence. A police force, for example, might well meet the stipulations of just war, use of violence. A justified revolt. One can imagine in South Africa, for example, that you would have a justified revolution or revolt on just war terms. Some kinds of limited warfare. We could talk, for example, about whether the Korean War was a just war on these terms. Overthrow of the rule by a tyrant, so on. But nuclear war and any war using mass indiscriminate weapons of destruction cannot be waged on just war terms. This means for nuclear policy that only the choices of crusader and pacifist remain, again, if this logic is sound. Or maybe there is a fourth. The crusader says the cause is just and anything that's necessary to ensure the success of the cause is justified. There might be a position which I wouldn't call a moral position, but which people do take, and that is simply revenge or retaliation. If they're going to destroy us, they're going to pay. I mean, even if it's total destruction on both sides. But I don't know how, in moral terms, and those of Christian faith, one can justify that one, or, in the light of nuclear weapons, a crusader position, even though it's held by many. I do know that given the unimaginable destruction entailed in nuclear holocaust, there has suddenly appeared what even the pacifists hardly expected, namely that the witness for nonviolence has taken on a certain realism when most people have relegated pacifism to some irrelevant utopianism. It was, in fact, not a pacifist, but a five-star general, Omar Bradley, who said that now we must learn to live the Sermon on the Mount or we simply will not survive. Suddenly, Jesus' notion of neighbor love extended to love the enemy becomes not just the high moral option for a few, but something approaching a moral necessity when we have the power that we have in our hands. So what has in the last few years developed is that the pacifist stance is no longer seen only as simply the credible witness to another reality, the kingdom of God, but is more directly relevant to policy in and for this present age than we had thought. But, of course, the question remains, and the just war advocates ask it, whether the demon of violence can, in fact, be exorcised. Now, there's still a vital place for just war thinking, namely as helpful thinking about the limiting of war, for judging about the proper use of force in many settings. And that is the task for Christians today, who take seriously the care of creation as their way of understanding the peacemaking vocation. What is happening, and I think it is very significant, is that now the pacifists and the just war people, and that includes many of you, because most people have these positions, whether they've thought them all the way through or not, find themselves in alliance with one another over against nuclear arms issues. And we ought to appreciate that instead of expending our energies on battles between Christian pacifists and Christian advocates of carefully limited violence. The pastoral letter has a helpful remark, if I can put my hand on it at the moment. After talking about the two possibilities out of the theology of the kingdom as a pacifist and just war ones, it goes on to say, both of these find their roots in the Christian theological tradition. Each contributes to the full moral vision we need in pursuit of human peace. We believe that the two perspectives support and complement one another, each preserving the other from distortion. That the two ought to go together, that they're part of a larger Christian understanding of faithfulness, and then in our present circumstances, Christian pacifists and Christian just violence advocates belong together. Let me just quit. And we've got a little time yet to for some discussion. Yeah.
Based on some of the information you've given us, what position do you see the Second World War as having been? Just war?
Invariably, the challenge to the pacifist is the challenge of a Hitler. What would you do if the likes of a Hitler arose? And there was a big discussion and breaks out every time a war breaks out between Christian pacifists and Christian just war advocates. And in this country, the case for the United States entering on the side of then what became our allies was made by Christians on the basis of just war criteria. There was a big debate, for example, around Reinhold Niebuhr on that score. And the war was prosecuted with an understanding that our participation was a participation in a just war to stem the victory of Nazism, which by just war thinking would have entailed more evil than the destruction used to halt Nazism. What's very interesting in that whole thing, so I'm saying yes to your question that I think there, among many Christians, a majority, it was regarded as a just war. What I found very interesting was that when the United States went later in the war to using weapons of mass destruction, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but not just that, the firebombings of Tokyo and so on, and when we advocated a policy of unconditional surrender, at that point, those who were arguing on the basis of just war conditions opposed U.S. policy, those particular policies. There, I read through old issues of Christianity in Crisis, which became the magazine that was the vehicle for just war thinking here. And they pleaded with the government of the United States not to adopt a policy of unconditional surrender and of carpetbagging of saturation bombing because it violated just war criteria. So my response to you is that the war was seen as just. As it progressed, some of the policies, strategic arms policies used, were then opposed by those who came from that very position. Yes. That the answer to that is yes. That still leaves you with an overall evaluation about it.
What was the position
of Vietnam? Vietnam is the case of late where again just war thinking among Christians was revived. And many refused to participate on the basis of just war criteria. In other words, the opposition to the draft was not simply by people who had regarded themselves as pacifists. Many of the young men said, I would have gone to fight against Hitler. But this war is, on just war terms, an unjust war, and I will not. Now, the logical legal position for Lutherans or others, people from other churches of just war traditions, is one of selective conscientious objection, or more technically, selective conscientious participation. One would say, we assume that all wars are unjust. There may be exceptions to that case. We will participate in the exceptions. But the laws of the United States have no place for selective conscientious participation when there is a draft. So young men who found themselves saying, this war does not meet the criteria of just war, either had to say, without integrity, yes, they really were pacifists all the time, and therefore COs, or they had to make some other choice. But in answer to your question, there were a lot of people who regarded Vietnam as an unjust war. Needless to say, there were lots of people who regarded it as a just war as well. But it was a time of another revival of the criteria of just war thought. Yeah?
For those who are legalistically minded, I think that one of the criteria of just war is that it has to be declared, or it's called cast in terms of King's declaration.
declaring the war is an enemy, another argument for not participating in the war was this was not a declared war. Our interests were clearly not jeopardized in that sense, that we were declared to be a war.
Yeah, that was one of the variations on the just war criterion, that it must be a war waged by socially responsible agents. And the argument was that it was undeclared, and therefore we were not bound by it. Yeah.
Is there a clarification of aid other people to fight? That's all included in the just war theory. Whether or not you're actually participating in anything above being totally neutral.
Come again. In just war thinking, one can certainly talk about aid to others. I mean, just war thinking is not one which thinks in national state terms. It thinks in terms of neighbor, and neighbor is a universal notion. All people are our neighbors. And so you if you're talking about restoration of rights or defending the innocent or something, one can think about assistance. One can think about allies, et cetera, in just war terms, if that's your question. Particular cases in the present are not taken up here other than a discussion of deterrence and nuclear arms policy. That is. But it doesn't take a case-by-case basis with respect to other things, El Salvador or cases of insurgency and so on. You could move to that, but they're not in the pastoral epistle. Yes?
Well, another thing that makes this particular troublesome right now is that we're not talking about being in war. We're talking about war preparation in the name of peacekeeping. And it's how to participate in war preparation, whether this goal or unjust thing that's happening that we should fight for.
That's right, and I'm very happy you brought that up, because one of the things I want to get into tomorrow with the pastoral epistle is the fact that most of the Christian traditions on thinking about war and peace are questions of about the participation in war. There is attention to prevention of war, but much of it is what do you do when there is war. Now we must talk about what do you do in order for war never to occur, at least this kind of war using weapons of mass destruction. So it is prevention that becomes the center of the Christian's thinking. That means that something like the just war thought needs to be turned a different direction, and you have to ask, what is the just peace ethic? And you have to say, not only does this situation using lethal violence measure up and do I participate in it, you have to ask, what is the proper use of lethal violence in the construction of a peaceful situation? I mean, you have to turn it a different direction. It has to be much more in the direction of prevention than away from simply the question of participation when it occurs.